From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The argument over bathrooms in this country has come to be focused on the rights of transgendered people in particular. But have you ever wondered how we ended up with separate bathrooms for men and women in the first place? The law professor Terry Kogan says it wasn't about health, really, or safety, or even at first modesty. We separated men and women's bathrooms mostly because men didn't know what to do about women leaving the home and entering the public workforce. That was it, Kogan says. It was social anxiety. So you saw these ideas arise and take hold that women were weaker and needed to be protected and separated. And men were seen as naturally creepy and predatory. Today in the program, we're talking about public bathrooms, the history, but also how the past has morphed into the concerns of today. Join us after the news.
Stay connected with KUER throughout the day on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll bring you stories from our local news team along with program updates and features from NPR, BBC, and other network providers. Get the scoop on upcoming events, meet your favorite public radio personalities, and find out what's happening at the station behind the scenes by following KUER on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the controversy over public bathrooms, which has come to be focused on the rights of transgendered people and whether keeping them from using the facility of their choice is discrimination and a necessary indignity. Now, by now, you know the setup for the discussion. It started in North Carolina several weeks ago when a controversial law was passed that said transgendered citizens must use the public bathroom that corresponded with their birth certificate, not the gender they identified with. Later, the Obama administration weighed in on the matter, issued a directive to public schools around the country that said transgendered students should be allowed to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. Here in Utah, state leaders, including the governor, have criticized the directive for various reasons. The state has signed on to a lawsuit with 10 other states to challenge it. So we're talking about why this issue is so contentious today. It is very personal, of course, and very intimate. For most of us, bathrooms are pretty private spaces. But there's a lot going on here, including a very fascinating history. So that's what we're talking about today. And we invite you to join the conversation if you've been doing some thinking about this issue. We hope you'll join us if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll begin with the current controversy. Joining us now on the program is Sherilyn Eager, who is a conservative blogger and writer and commentator. She hosts a radio program on a local radio station, KTKK, that's K-Talk. She's joining us today by phone from Salt Lake City. Sherilyn Eager, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and to work with some good colleagues at another station there. You do good work.
Thanks. Let's start broadly, if we could. What is this about? Boil it down for me, your main concern, because I'm guessing you're less concerned about overreach by President Obama, although you probably are, but less concerned about that and more concerned about your concerns over safety, maybe even morality. Boil it down for us.
All right, let's go back, if you will, because you promote this as there has been a history, and that is true. I'm probably one of the few that were actually on the front lines of an issue years ago that arose with the Title IX regulations that emerged from Washington, D.C. And at the time, there were a group of us that were looking forward and predicting that at some point in time, the Title IX regulations could be misused and abused, and in fact, could compel what we called then unisex bathrooms. Mm-hmm. Well, at the time, this was in the mid-70s, we were laughed at, we were mocked, and it's interesting that the same people today that are actually promoting this are the ones that were laughing at us several decades ago. So that's some history. Title IX was intended, of course, to bring more, quote, equality to women in sports and in the college atmosphere, school atmosphere. And in fact, we believed that it could at some point actually compromise women's sports. So now, fast forward to gender identity and the confusion and the misunderstanding. So I think the next point is, Doug, that we have to separate out homosexuality itself from what the DSM-5 defines as gender dysphoria, which is a disorder. And so my disclaimer here...
They don't actually call it gender dysphoria anymore. They call it gender identity disorder. I just want to point that out.
DSM-5, and I have a copy of it. I won't contend that with you right now, but gender dysphoria is in DSM-5.
Well, we'll get to this question of it being a disorder here in a moment. But again, broadly, what's the problem as you see it? You've explained the history. That's interesting. What's the issue here? Boil it down.
The issue is that gender dysphoria, gender identity, transgenderism, and the idea that government can compel a unisex bathroom environment is not only overreach, but it also is a disservice to people that really need our help and our compassion and support, not in ways that compromise the majority of women who want to go into a bathroom or a shower or a locker room and have their privacy. And so that is overreach by President Obama. I am concerned about that. On a practical level, what we boil down to is, do I as a woman want a man to walk into my restroom because he is confused about his gender and therefore is entering my space to use a feminist term? It's my body, it's my biology, and this is my place to be.
But what is he going to do what are you proposing that he's going to do in that space that's offensive to you?
That is the unpredictable factor, because how are you practically going to monitor who's the transgender? Are you going to license?
I know, but let's put that aside for a minute. What are you proposing but what are you thinking this person is going to do? Oogle you? Going to attack you? I mean, what is the thing that you're basically worried about?
Here's the thing that I am concerned about, and the majority of parents and children, boys and girls, in Europe right now, there are grade schools that have unisex bathrooms. They don't have doors on the stalls. The boys and girls can go in together, and the parents who want modesty for their children are told, you're the ones that are weird. You're the ones that are abnormal. I am sorry, but I have a different standard of what my modesty is and what my level of protection should be. There is no protection whatsoever for a man who wants to take advantage and abuse this regulation that President Obama is trying to mandate. And to prevent that sort of person from coming into a bathroom, there have been incidents where that has been happening. Now, maybe they think it's a joke right now, but how are you going to monitor and manage that? You're going to have somebody, you know, have to show their DNA sample or, you know, a license to their DNA. I don't know. This is ridiculous. It is absurd. It is outrageous. I have a level of modesty, even with my own husband, thank you. And maybe it's different for other people. Maybe sex ed with, you know, co-educational information being given at kids has just broken down the sense of modesty that most of us have had growing up. But that's where I am. I went to a girls' school in Los Angeles. I didn't even want to undress fully in front of the other girls. And I wasn't alone.
So it's an issue of modesty for you?
It's an issue of having a place to be where there can be safety and privacy.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay. And you know, if the 0.01% of the transgendered out there, whatever it is, want that, then let them go into a private bathroom. There are places that those exist, but you don't turn upside down the culture for the vast majority of Americans just because one set of people are confused. They need to get help, and they need good advice. And by the way, Walt Heyer, H-E-Y-E-R, is a fabulous resource on this. He's a formerly transgendered man. He reversed his surgery, And he helps people all over this country know how to deal with the regret or the remorse that they feel when they maybe change their mind later on in their life and then find themselves sterile. These are issues that surround transgenderism that we're not hearing about. We're not hearing the medical side of it. Because
okay, hold on. Silent. Okay, great. Let me ask you that. It sort of raises a question. So you believe that being transgendered is an explicit choice that someone makes? Or do you think that there's something biological here, that they're born with this identity?
I don't believe that people are born with an identity. I believe that they are born with DNA. And I do believe that there is an XXY anomaly that can be taken care of, but we should not be teaching parents to play around with the gender of their children. I have 5 sons that I've raised. Every single one of them at one point in their growing up years has paraded around in my high heels or maybe wanted to put on a dress or some of my makeup or whatever. That is not a signal to me that my child may be homosexual or may have transgender.
But Ms. Eager, that's not fair to say that because one of your sons or a couple of your sons may have put on high heels at one point, that's not at all equated with the transgender experience for young people. I mean, that's not a fair comparison.
If you let me answer your question.
Well, I will, but let me ask the question and then answer it. It doesn't seem like a fair comparison to say that you anecdotally having a couple of sons who may have worn a dress or a pair of high heels once or twice equates with the real experience of transgendered people. That doesn't seem fair.
It's not anecdotal. And I might also...
No, it is anecdotal. It's by definition anecdotal. It's your anecdote. Of course it is.
It's my experience.
Right. That's an anecdote.
Then I challenge you to put out a poll there among parents. How many of their boys have ever dressed up in their mom's high-heeled shoes and walked around the house? But wouldn't you concede that
there's a difference between that and being transgendered?
Walt Heyer has a very excellent experience that he shares. He had a grandmother that dressed him up in dresses and little girl things. And so that was his experience. I do know that the psychiatrists that I have been in touch with have explained that this resembles an anorexia syndrome where the patient presents, and John Hopkins and other institutions have also shared the research on this, that they present as anorexic would in that they perceive themselves to be something entirely with what is in front of them or what is reality. And so,
okay, Ms. Eager, I want to get away from adjudicating the question of science right now. I don't know anything about
these.
Hold on.
Medical science is being buried, and if you don't want to
fine.
Go there.
Fine. No. I don't want to go there right now because I don't know anything about this person you mentioned, nor the science that you're presenting. That's not actually why I wanted you on the program.
Okay, well, it's okay.
Here's what I have a question about.
It is a major part of it because
certainly
bury the medical science.
Medical science is a major part of it, absolutely. But that's not what I'm trying to get a sense from you about is what it is that you're concerned about. That's what I'm interested in.
I have explained this entire interview my concerns.
Oh, great. Okay. That's right. But I want to stay away from the science part because I can't confirm anything about the science that you're mentioning, and I just don't want to adjudicate that right now if it's all the same to you. Let me ask you about this. The questions of, do you think that transgendered people want to go into bathrooms and in some way get sexually titillated? By looking that they're going.
That is not the question. That is not the question.
That's not the question.
I am talking about opening up a private place in a public setting for women to be and to provide the utmost decorum and safety for all of those women. We know that there are and will be men and predators, which are not typically the transgendered in this situation, that will abuse this. How are you or anybody going to monitor that? How is that to be monitored? How do we know? We don't know right now. But right. I will say this. It is a matter of a parental rights issue when you have in a public school setting, which this is, and we have parents who have minor children, and those parents have the right to determine what that environment is for their children. And so if parents want to teach their children that gender is assigned, and in some religious settings, it is believed that that is an eternal assignment, then how are you going to avoid offending either those folks' religious beliefs and rights or the right of the parent to choose whether their children aren't being, conditioned to believe that this is somehow a normal thing, and they too ought to be questioning their gender. That, to me, is abusive.
Okay, let me ask you this finally. What should happen? Let's take a 12-year-old boy. He's born male, but identifies female. He's transgendered. She's transgendered. Let's put it that way. I'll put it that way. What should happen to that 12-year-old person who identifies that way in a public school setting? What do you recommend?
First of all, it is very difficult to take a hypothetical and then place a standard response to it.
Give it a shot.
I would have to know what the situation was with that child. Is this something that the parents
What should happen to transgendered people in terms of public restrooms? What's the solution for you?
Well, there isn't a solution that is going to be good for the majority of women if the Obama administration succeeds in what they call their guidance, which isn't, because it is a mandate unless you want to forego the Title IX funding. And so that is a good recommendation for every state to withdraw from that funding. It is a minor amount of funding anyway, and for the state of Utah, it certainly can be replaced. And we do have members of our legislature that are looking into that option as we speak. So that would be a good solution. Take the federal regulations out of the mix, and then Utah is able to decide what the parents of Utah want. That would be the public answer. Now, your question was, if I were a parent or if I knew somebody that had a 12-year-old boy that was identifying, then I would find the best psychological help for the child, work through it.
Where do they go to the bathroom?
What the situation is. Where does that? There are private bathrooms.
Okay.
Meaning single stalls that have locks on them, and that is a temporary solution until the issue can be dealt with by professionals who know how to help people who are going through all kinds of emotional struggles in their lives. And there is nothing unusual about the psychologists that do deal with the transgendered. And by the way, they are being silenced and shut down, and that is unconscionable. And so we are working with that national task force of therapists that are seeking for their equal rights to be able to practice in their professions the way they know has been successful.
Do you believe gay people can be cured? Do you believe in reparative therapies for homosexuals?
I think there has been great success in those therapies, those change therapies, that when a parent or an adult has had a struggle and they want to work their way through it and figure it out, there are numerous examples of clients that have come in, and as the therapists say, you know, they peeled away the onion and they find the real core issue that has been the problem, and they're able to help them through that. And yes, there is hope for people who do want
you do know that those actual tactics, by and large, in the medical community have been not only disputed but rejected.
That is the politically correct association of psychologists, and they've been taken over by a mentality that really truly does believe that. But in reality, there are wonderful outcomes.
Sherrilyn Eager is a conservative blogger, writer, has a program on KTKK. It's a local talk radio station, joined us by phone from Salt Lake City. Ms. Eager, thank you very much for taking the time.
And by the way, I do come from a theatrical background. I have many wonderful friends who are of the homosexual lifestyle and persuasion.
Really?
And I do.
Name a couple. Name some names of your gay
really
friends.
I don't want to put their names out in the public.
Yeah, people often say that they have good friends, but they don't want to really list the names. Just name a couple. I'm sure they wouldn't mind.
Okay, I will give them all to you offline, and I'll talk to them and ask them if it's okay.
Okay.
If I put their names out there.
Sherrilyn Eager, thank you very much for your time.
New York City, and I admire them greatly.
Thanks very much for the time.
They're talented people. Thank you.
We're going to take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to make sense of the incredibly heated debate over public bathrooms, who should be allowed into which restroom, men's or women's. The Obama administration has weighed in. The president says public school students should be able to choose the facility that corresponds with their gender identity. Opponents of the idea, including Utah state leaders, say they're worried about government overreach, but also what they see as the dangers of a kind of gender free-for-all in public bathrooms around the country. So we've been talking a little bit about that. We're trying to get a sense of the history of this, too. And we're joined by Terry Kogan, who's a professor at the University of Utah S.J. Quinney College of Law, where he teaches about sexuality and the law, among other areas of study. His article about the origins of sex-separated bathrooms in America appeared in a collection of essays called Toilet, Public Restrooms and the Politics of Sharing. We'll be talking a little bit about that. He's joining us today. He's traveling. He's in a studio in New York City. And Professor Kogan, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Doug.
I wanted to get a few things out of the way that were mentioned in our conversation with Sherrilyn Eager, because I'm afraid we might have been left with a lot of confusion related to the scientific questions about gender identity and those kinds of things. Is there any tidying up you want to do, Professor Kogan, that you heard from Sherrilyn Eager?
Sure. So let me address one or two points that Ms. Eager raised. First, and perhaps most importantly, the bottom line is this. There are bad people out there. There are rapists. There are pedophiles who do horrific things to women, to children. These people have not been sitting at home waiting for the Obama administration to issue its directive to have permission to go into bathrooms to do their horrific deeds. That men have been attacking women in bathrooms, in all kinds of spaces. Men and women have been attacking children in bathrooms and in other spaces. And the onset of the current controversy has in no way changed what has gone on for a very long time. The idea that somehow the Obama administration's directive or the local ordinance in Charlotte, North Carolina, that was overturned by the state, that those directives that are aimed at protecting trans people in their use of public bathrooms, the idea that that gives permission to bad people to do these bad deeds is a total red herring. So that's the first point I want to make. The second point, and I think we have to keep focused on this, that the population at which the Obama administration directive is aimed at protecting, the population of children who are self-identifying as transgender, the population of transgender people in general has for many years been an incredibly vulnerable population in our society, a population subject to harassment, subject to bullying, and studies show that approximately 70% of people who self-identify as transgender have faced situations in public restrooms where they have been verbally assaulted, they have been physically assaulted, and on occasion they have been arrested. So this is a population that for many years has struggled with the issue of how do I go into public and what happens when I have that basic human need to use a toilet facility knowing that I might be attacked one way verbally or physically, one way or another when I enter that kind of space.
It's interesting how much is packed into this question. It's about sexuality. It's about gender. It's about access. It's about disability. And of course, it all sort of built around these biological necessities. What do you think is revealed in this subject about what's it about? Is it about culture? Is it about power? Is it about, there's law, there's history. I mean, what's this about broadly?
Well, so broadly, it seems to me the issue of public restrooms implicates some of the deepest psychological anxieties that plague what it means to be human and that have been with us from the beginning of time. Psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists have written about how those aspects of our life that surround human elimination raise concerns about bodies, about body parts, in a way that very, very few other aspects of our lives raise such anxiety. And I think those kinds of emotional psychological forces are what is behind the controversy now and what has been behind concerns over bathrooms for a very long time.
The sociologist Harvey, is it Mulloch? Anyway, he contributed to the book that you did, and he identified this problem at hand. He said that in a public toilet, the animal in us comes to the fore, and so we have to accommodate its tendencies and its demands. I wanted to get you to say something about that. I think you just did. I guess this is really dealing with some really kind of private, intimate, basic inclinations here. I guess that's why it's so controversial.
And I think that's right. One thing that it's important to point out, two things about the Obama administration directive. We have to keep focused on the fact that it is aimed at public school children. It is not aimed at opening up restrooms or locker rooms in public schools to anyone who wants to walk in off of the street. It is a way of protecting specific students in public schools who self-identify at some point, often with their parents' support, as transgender, and then need a range of support from the school administration related to facilities, related to not being bullying. One can imagine the difficulty of a young child who decides at some point during school to transition from their appearing in accord with their birth sex to their gender, their sense of their own gender identity by changing clothing, whatever. The occasions, the opportunities for harassment, for being attacked, rise exponentially. And accordingly, those students need special protection from school administrations. The other thing, and this is important to point out because it counters a point made earlier, that throughout the Obama the Obama administration's directive as well as the policies in a document giving examples of supporting that directive, there is stress on the importance of providing private spaces for students who are uncomfortable for whatever reason with using a public restroom, with using an open locker room. These students can be transgender students or they can be cisgendered students, regularly gendered students. Right. But the directive stresses that if an individual comes to the administration and says, I am concerned about this new policy and being in the same restroom with a transgender student, the school is to take special steps to try to create a private space for that student.
Let's work through some of the history, because I think this is fascinating. We have to go back many years, more than 100, in fact, to sort of get at the time we first started to segregate men and women's bathrooms. And what's interesting, one of the things that you've been writing about is that the motivation wasn't so much about protecting people from, you know, lewd individuals. It was social anxiety about women who were becoming part of the workforce. Would you say something just broadly about that? Because this
Sure.
seems to be the sort of main point in some ways.
Okay. So it seems to me there are two critical questions about the history of sex separation of public restrooms that need to be addressed. One, why in the world at the end of the 19th century did states begin adopting statutes, enacting legislation that mandated that public restrooms be separated by sex and that individuals of one sex not be allowed to enter the space for the other sex? So that's the first question.
Yeah.
And most of my writing has focused on that question. The second question, which I am now exploring, is, well, these laws were in place by the turn of the 20th century. How is it over 100 years later that the very same laws remain on the books? What was it that kept these laws intact, unchanging, until very recently, when we are beginning the dialogue that you, Doug, have been talking about over the last minutes? So let's address the first question. How did we get to the place at the end of the 19th century where states began adopting legislation mandating that bathrooms be segregated by sex? Well, the first thing to point out is the first such law, which was in Massachusetts in 1887, was about factory bathrooms. And all of the first laws in the country, the first being 1887, by 1920, there were over 40 states that had adopted these laws, were about public workplaces, mostly factories. And what I discovered when I began exploring the origin of the laws was this, that basically from early in American history until roughly 1800, mm-hmm. The beginning of the 19th century, the home had been the center for commerce, for social life throughout America. Goods were created in the home, sold out of the home, and men and women worked together. Beginning at the beginning of the 19th century, largely as a result of the Industrial Revolution, manufacturing moved out of the home and into centralized locations, factories. And men, beginning at the beginning of the 19th century, left the home to go work in factories. Women stayed in the home, raising children, tending hearth fires.
Yeah.
And as a result, shortly after the beginning of the 19th century, an ideology arose in the United States, which historians have called the separate spheres ideology. And what this ideology was all about was this. Basically, the public, the factory, politics, space outside the home became understood as the proper domain for men,
yeah.
and the private home became the proper domain for women. And along with this was a vision of women as vulnerable, but as in some ways virtuous, staying at home, raising the next generation of Americans, taking care of their families.
So this is the point when society starts to put women on a pedestal, seeing them of having more moral sensibilities than men. This is the cult of true womanhood, I think, is how
that's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
But the problem is, you mentioned in your book, is it was a myth. I mean, of course, not at all realistic about the real role of women. I mean, not only were they entering the workforce, you say, they were participating in the community. You know, there was suffrage and there were social reform movements, and men were just kind of freaking out about all of that, I guess.
So that's right. So by 1820, to take an obvious example, when the textile mills in the Northeast opened and needed a significant workforce, women left the home in droves to work in the factories. So what's happening is you have this cultural myth about virtuous women and their proper place being in the home, and you have the reality of 19th century economics, mm-hmm. where women are leaving the home to take jobs in the public. And one comes up against this clash where, though people understood that women had to leave the home to support the economy, every time a woman left the home, there was a kind of social concern raised.
Yeah.
So by 1850, what you find happening is states began adopting protective labor legislation. And the first labor legislation adopted in the 1850s was directed, as I describe it, at the bodies of women, at protecting women who were viewed as inherently weaker than men. Legislation included limiting the hours women could work, requiring a seat at their workstation, requiring that women be given a rest period during the day, all suggesting that a woman has a weaker body and therefore when she goes into the public, she has to be protected.
Forgive me. Go ahead. I'll tell you what I want to talk about because I think it's so interesting. You write about that planners start to create these home-like separate spheres,
yes.
like in hotels and restaurants and, I mean, forget bathrooms for a moment, banks and post offices and public parks and even libraries. They have these cordoned off places where the virtuous, modest women can be separate from the animal-like men.
Right. So, as I just suggested, the first laws were directed at women's weaker bodies. But at the same time, regulators, planners, architects began creating architectural spaces that were aimed at protecting those spaces that women occupied when they left the home and entered the public realm. So as you suggest, one discovers that, for example, in public libraries, until the 1840s, 1850s, women weren't allowed in public libraries. Mm-hmm. When they finally opened their doors to women, the concerns about women coming into the public and into these libraries were very real for those who planned these spaces. And accordingly, you find that there was something created called the ladies' reading room, that there was a special space where women could go outside of the gaze of leering men to do their reading. And curiously enough, what kinds of books and periodicals were these rooms stocked with? Books about the home and about sewing, right? Books that sort of recreating, in a sense, the idea that these special spaces were somewhat like the home, even though they were in public. And then, Doug, as you point out, there were salons created exclusively for the use of women in hotels, in banks, in department stores, which were growing up throughout this period. And then very interestingly, as train travel developed beginning in really the 1840s, they started putting a separate ladies' car at the end of the train where women and their male escorts were the only ones allowed to use it, so that women would be protected from the hoi polloi of the men in the drinking cars. And interestingly enough, the car was put at the end of the train because if there was a train crash, those who were closer to the front were more likely to be injured. So there is an informal history, not mandated by law, by 1850s, 1860s, of separating out architectural spaces, and the bathroom, the public bathroom, which gets in factories, where the first laws apply to mandate sex separation, grows out of that architectural history.
You write that it was a violation of Victorian modesty for any part of a woman's anatomy to be subjected to public scrutiny while she performed intimate bodily functions. And you even say that Victorian modesty was even threatened if a woman could be seen entering the facility.
Right. So what happens between roughly 1850 and the end of the 1880s, when these first laws were enacted, were several things. One, there was this new growing focus on sanitation in America, largely because of cholera epidemics during the Civil War and the extraordinary number of deaths that resulted from those epidemics. Social planners, known as sanitarians, began focusing on cleaning up America, which was a very filthy place. Yeah. They began focusing on developing public work systems that would enable sewage to be carried away from buildings, waterborne to central locations. Prior to the 1870s, when these technologies were developing, basically people used outhouses, which emptied into cesspools or privy vaults, often behind a building. And this is true even in factories. Once in a while, there would be a corner sort of toilet room in a factory, but nothing like we understand toilet rooms to be. The point is this. Until the 1870s, the very possibility of a multi-user restroom was technologically not possible. So issues surrounding how we're going to separate restrooms by sex really couldn't have arisen until the 1870s. Secondly, as we move later into the 19th century, factories get viewed as more and more dangerous places because of newfangled machinery, which they were. Yeah. The number of injuries that occurred in factories increased significantly the later in the century you moved. And last but not least is exactly what you just pointed to, Doug, which is with the rise of the Victorian era, late in the 19th century, there was a great concern about issues of modesty and privacy, and these concerns were brought to the fore in the factory where men and women worked next to one another. That in a sense, in that setting, if there was any threat to a woman's modesty, it would be in that kind of workplace. These forces came together in the 1880s and led legislators to aim their sights on bathrooms in factories. And the idea was this. By that point, though the sort of vision of the separate spheres ideology, women are weaker and should remain at home, continued to pervade American culture, everyone had given up on the possibility that women might possibly be forced back into the home. Mm-hmm. No one thought it would happen. So what was done? What was done was in the spirit of earlier in the century of cordoning off special architectural spaces for women, legislators mandated that there be a separate women's bathroom. And what is important is that though one might think, well, wait a minute. I mean, it didn't say a separate women's bathroom. It said that there be separate bathrooms for men and women. Why wasn't that simply a gender-neutral requirement? And what's critical to point out is that if you look at this legislation in virtually every one of the 40 states that adopted the legislation by 1920, the title of it would be something like Legislation to Protect Women and Children in the Workplace. That is to say, the legislation that created the requirement of separating public restrooms was an extension of the legislation earlier in the century that was aimed at protecting women's bodies.
We need to take a quick break. When we get back, I want to get to that question, the other part of the equation that you mentioned, and that is, why is it that these laws have stayed in place and unchanged? Terry Kogan is with us, professor at the University of Utah S.J. Quinney College of Law. We will take a quick break and be back in a moment for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the heated debate over public bathrooms. Terry Kogan is joining us now, professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. He, among other things, he teaches classes about sexuality and the law. So, professor, are you seeing it? I'm wondering if now we have sort of come to a point, have we replaced the social anxiety about women being in the workforce with social anxiety over sexual orientation and gender identity? Is that what this is sort of about now in the 21st century?
It's an interesting question. So my reaction is this, that I believe that the anxiety over women and women's bodies that began at the beginning of the 19th century has never left us. So I think that is part of the equation. I do think, as a sheer matter of practical politics, that the issues we're now facing concerning transgender individuals and their right to use public bathrooms has arisen in large part because the marriage equality debate has now been lost to conservative thinkers. Having lost the fight against same-sex marriage, this is the next front in the war against sexual politics. But I do not think that the sort of sexist aspects of the sexist vision that underlay the first laws at the end of the 19th century has disappeared. I think that is part of, right, that's embodied in the concern that women are vulnerable in public places, in public restrooms. And moreover, as our prior speaker in a sense suggested, in the eyes of conservative thinkers, they're vulnerable to this sick population of people. Obviously, a view that I greatly disagree with. But these various forces have joined together to propel the current controversy.
What about in other countries? I think there would be the inclination to believe that places like Northern Europe may have less compunctions about gendered bathrooms at this point. Are you seeing models in other places that could be adopted at some point in this country?
So the finest model that I have experienced was at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, the old train station that now is a museum. I was visiting there, had reason to use the bathroom, went down to the basement, and lo and behold, there is a doorless room. That is, there is no door on the bathroom, and you look in, and on one wall, it is a wall of stalls with floor-to-ceiling doors, and on the other wall is a wall of sinks. And men and women are walking in and out. going into their private closed stalls, doing what they have to do, coming out, washing, and leaving. And French culture has gone on quite well. No one was suffering a major hysteria or anxiety as a result of men and women sharing a bathroom space. What is nice about the space is I like the fact that there was no door on it because it provides for a greater surveillance in terms of sounds, and if something untoward is happening, people outside can hear. I actually think mixing sexes provides an added surveillance so that a man who is thinking about attacking a woman will probably think twice if he knows that there may be men as well as women watching him. That's total speculation, but I think there's something to it. So there are models out there. And what I think we as a society need to do is to open up our minds, to understand that, in fact, the origins of our current practice really were based in a sexist vision of weak women. And we have given up that vision, or many of us have given up that vision at the beginning of the 21st century. We now need to expand our sense of architectural spaces and what can be done to provide safe, accessible bathrooms for everyone in our society.
It's Terry Kogan, law professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, joined us from a studio today in New York City. Professor, thanks for the time.
It's been a pleasure, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.